Hello everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Rut, the podcast which explores the extraordinary stories, psychology, and often quite deep intricacies of men's mental health. Another quick shout out to everybody who has donated to our Movember page so far. We've raised almost $3,000, which is just incredible. There's been a lot of you who have been messaging us on Instagram and about Movember. We're going to keep going right up until the last minute, trying to take some more money off the general public, but all in aid of this amazing cause, which is men's health and men's mental health, and raise awareness for it. This week as well, I'm going to be running some Instagram lives on our Instagram page, at The Rut Pod, for those of you who are new to the podcast or haven't been on our Instagram yet. And I'm going to be interviewing some of the Rut Mobro team who have their own little backstories as to why they're raising money this year. Please also remember to subscribe if you have not listened to the podcast before, or you are listening to each episode and you haven't hit the subscribe button. We've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of you who have subscribed so far, and your support is one of the reasons why we keep going with this podcast and to continue to highlight men's mental health. So please do leave us a review, hit the subscribe button, check out our social medias, media pages in the show notes, and we're looking forward to bringing you further on this journey into exploring men's mental health. This next episode is a pretty timely episode for my next guest. I welcome England Sevens rugby player Alex Davis to the podcast this week. We recorded this episode in late August, just after it had been announced that the RFU was cutting the Sevens programme entirely. However, this will be released tomorrow on Tuesday the 24th of November, and it was the 5-year anniversary of Alex's dad's passing on Friday the 20th, only a few days ago. This episode is a really lovely tribute actually to Alex's dad, who was Alex's inspiration for getting on a rugby pitch and realising his dreams of playing professional rugby. Alex's dad unfortunately passed away from leukemia in 2015, and it left an enormous void in his life, triggering grief-related depression and mental health issues. Alex signed his first England Sevens contract in 2014, making his debut in Australia on the World Series that year. In 2016, he was selected in the 12-man squad that went to Rio, but he broke his ankle in training and he missed out on selection, which was such a bitter pill to swallow after his dad's death only 7 months before. We spend just over an hour exploring how Alex overcame the problems he faced, what he does now to make sure he's mentally right. We discuss the obligatory rugby nausing on England Sevens and what on earth happened there, and his work with Movember. So, let's get into this one. Here's Alex's story, so please leave all judgment at the door. Alex, welcome to The Rut. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, James. Pleasure to be here in The Rut. It's a beautiful day.
Mate, it's so warm.
It's a bit warm, might be too warm.
Mate, literally been discussing how I slept on ice packs last night. So,
yeah, so, ingenious.
Mate, I'm the warmest man in the UK right now, it's awful. Sweating my nags off.
I'd be out of this vest if it wasn't for the listeners and the watchers, but...
Yeah, mate, this is going up on YouTube,
so... Yeah, got to keep it strictly PG.
Single man is revealing himself. I ask everybody who comes on the pod this question. Why did you want to come on?
Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's, I think it's a great thing what you're doing in terms of highlighting men's health. And for me, that's something that I'm passionate about through my own experiences, and I want to essentially, I guess, be a bit of a voice and a role model around it, particularly for young men growing up, experiencing the world and the trials and tribulations of life. So for me to be able to come on The Rut, speak about mental health and my experiences with it is a brilliant opportunity. So yeah, I'm really excited by it. It should be cool.
Mate, nice. I appreciate it. I've obviously seen parts of your story and have listened to a lot of the stuff you've put out there so far, and especially your Instagram and stuff, and you've been through the ringer over the last few years.
Yeah.
So it's I'm excited for this.
Yeah,
this,
well, it's good
this hour.
Yeah, it's good to have these chats. We've already obviously spoken a fair bit, but like for me, they're like therapy sessions.
Good.
Like I've recognized the power of speaking and chatting to people, whether they're close friends or I guess strangers. Like
yeah.
There's power in speech. So yeah.
Good man. Let's dive into it. Set the scene for how Alex Davis came into the world, grew up as a young man, and in particular, obviously, your mental health issues really stems from your dad's death in passing away, which we'll get onto later. But I want to explore what Alex Davis was like as a young kid growing up first.
Yeah. Stig of the Dump springs to mind. You know that Rufio character in Peter Pan? I like to think of myself as him a little
really?
Bit. Yeah. I was just like, I was kind of a bit of a wild wanderer as a kid. Like I used to love, as a family, we used to go on like a lot of outdoor orientated like holidays, like camping and stuff was a big part of our lives growing up. And so I used to love like, yeah, the nature aspect of it all and climbing trees. My mum would hate me climbing trees because she was just, her mind would run away with the fact that I was going to fall from a great height and injure myself, whereas I obviously had no care in the world for that.
No.
The brilliance of and naivety of youth was on my side.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I loved being a bit of a free spirit, I guess. And my mum and dad were kind of, although they were worried about me injuring myself at the same time, they were very happy for me to explore and test the boundaries a little bit. And I probably did push the boundaries a bit too much now and then, climbing scaffolding outside of our house, falling off and breaking my arm at like the age of 8. So that was a good start to the world. But
generally speaking, very like happy-go-lucky kind of kid.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, very much so. As I said, like I did push the boundaries a bit. I was a bit of a nuisance at school, bit of a distraction, my teachers would say. One of those, what they say, those pupils that has potential but doesn't really put the effort in, which is everyone's kind of worst nightmare, I guess. But I don't know, I was just pretty fixated on playing and having a laugh and enjoying myself. That was kind of my mindset in a lot of ways, and I like to test that and I guess test people's patience a little bit. But yeah, very happy-go-lucky. Loved like just a passion for life, which I still have now. And I love my younger years. Like I look back on them very fondly, just family time, lots of activity, sports related. And just a close-knit family. I guess kind of quite a typical British family, like mum and dad, brother and sister. Regular, kind of pretty regular.
Your rugby is obviously the biggest part of your life, or one of them.
Yeah, massively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really where you connected with your dad, Nick, the most, right?
Yeah, hugely.
How did that relationship develop? Was he one of these kind of dads that would come onto the pitch if you'd slice the ball into touch? Or
no, he wasn't like he wasn't a pushy parent.
Right.
He was very involved in my rugby coaching from the age of like 6 when I first started at the local club in Bristol, and was sort of involved up until the age of like 16, 17, along with some of my other mates' dads. So it was like one of those, as we would move up an age group, they would move up with us. And my dad also was a keen rugby player when he was similar age to me, and I guess was still clinging on to those dreams, like occasionally going on vets tours and stuff. And mum would be sending him off for the weekend with all the dads, and the dads would be like, yes, weekend away with all the vets, pints, and the typical kind of rugby club stories you hear about. And so we just had that shared love and passion and relationship, which we built through that. And I think he certainly wanted to see me flourish, and tried to do whatever he could to help me in that kind of, well, I guess succeed.
And when you talk about success, like when it was becoming clear to you and your dad that rugby, you were fucking good at rugby. And actually, there's a real possibility that you're going to live out the dream, become a professional rugby player, which you now have done. Did you find any pressure to become that type of player? Because your dad was pushing you in a really good way, by the way, but he was pushed. Did you ever find the pressure there?
Yeah, I certainly put pressure on myself because I was playing amongst, I was getting recognition from like county or representative rugby, and I was playing amongst my schoolmates, and I wanted us to achieve and be successful as a school team or as a club team. And even sometimes we would be winning matches comfortably, but I was putting pressure on us, to like pressure on the team and also myself to basically kind of put a perfect performance together, which I don't know why I was putting such pressure on myself, but I would be disappointed and upset and at times visibly emotional about,
really,
yeah, like about, I remember one time coming off of a school game, we'd won like 40 odd nil, but I had noticed like the attitude of my teammates towards the end of the match had kind of switched off, but I was so set on, had this fixed mindset about that we had to finish the match and to the final whistle, and because I'd seen like the rest of the lads kind of detach themselves from the game with 10 minutes to play, like for some reason or another that just really cut me up, that almost like people didn't care, whereas I had just got so caught up in the fact that we needed to win and we needed to put this performance together. So I was putting pressure on myself in that aspect. I'm not sure whether my dad did, to be fair, not that I can remember. Like, he would obviously drive me to all the camps and pay for equipment or tours, whatever it may be.
Of course, yeah.
But I can't really remember him ever like sitting me down after a match, for instance, and being like, you could have done this better, or this wasn't, like, you missed this opportunity, how, like, we need to fix this. But he would always be there if I asked him, be like, can we practice my passing, or can we get on the pitch and do some kicking? He'd be like, yeah, absolutely, straight away.
How did he show you love? Was it through rugby?
Yeah.
Amongst other things, of course, but yeah, mostly through rugby.
Mostly. Obviously, being coach, he was just like super proud. And particularly as my career went on and I was gaining success and recognition in terms of playing for certain teams, he might post on, like, when parents were getting into Facebook and they couldn't quite understand it, he'd like post a photo of like him washing my shirt in the sink because it was all muddy.
Wow.
And publicly express his proudness of me. And that was obviously in such a public forum, that was like touching and special for me.
Of course.
Because we had such a shared love for the sport. Obviously amongst other things, it was, but certainly rugby was a massive avenue for him to express his love and pride towards me, for sure.
Interesting.
Yeah. There was probably the easiest form for him and me to, I guess, properly emotionally connect. And I've spoken about this to other people, that like my dad was similar to me kind of growing up, like Mr. Happy-go-lucky, and nothing was ever really a problem. If ever was a problem, it's just like, oh, it is what it is. Like, we move on, like we adapt kind of thing.
Very present as a human being.
Yeah. But at the same time, as we've all started to recognize, that can have, it's like, it can be quite damaging because you're not actually sometimes acknowledging the fact that, right, something is maybe a little bit wrong here or something needs to be addressed.
Of course, yeah.
And so we as a family have maybe spoken about the fact that maybe my dad could have been a bit more, I guess, emotionally available. But rugby was certainly a massive avenue, like, to express himself and for me and him to connect.
I find that really interesting because generally speaking, men aren't very emotionally available anyway.
Yeah.
It's only really our generation with this drive, in my opinion, with this drive to be more, I suppose, mentally conscious of themselves and their emotions, that you're seeing this driven, this dynamic in men to really feel a different kind of attachment. And I suppose it's funny that you've kind of looked back on that now and been like, that's something that he could have done more. But actually, his way of showing you love was through your rugby.
Yeah.
And that is incredibly... My dad's the same. I mean, when I was... I mean, I played for Old Pisporians, but...
Yeah.
But, or used to, until I fucked my knee. But his way of showing me love was to take me to Wasps on a Sunday.
Yeah.
And was at all of my games during the
week. Yeah. Well, I think that's, like... I guess that's, like, the traits of rugby, isn't it? Like, rugby has all, like, for a long period of time, obviously the women's sport is growing massively and it's epic to see the transformation of that, but obviously for such a long time it was a dads and lads sport, and it would be rugby on a Sunday down the rugby club fixtures and into the clubhouse afterwards, and that would be where you'd spend so much time with your father. And so I think that's just where bonds are created, and he... Obviously, rugby's growing as a sport, and its identity is changing a bit, but to be more like sort of all inclusive. But certainly, probably 20 years ago, let's say 15, 20 years ago, when I was sort of just getting into the game, it was still probably stuck in its old roots, where it was quite sort of, as I said, dads and lads, male orientated, testosterone driven, sort of those taboos and stigmas that are around rugby and.
Mm.
And the sport.
I want to move into... you went to Loughborough.
Yeah.
I think...
Mighty Loughborough.
The mighty, mighty Loughborough.
I'm not biased at all.
No. I went to Trent, so I know a little bit about Loughborough.
Yeah.
One or two nights out at Loughborough.
Yeah.
But it was at Loughborough when things really started to become intense.
Mm-hmm.
Your dad's health.
Yeah.
Started to deteriorate.
Yeah.
What happened there?
So it would have been, I think it was my second year of university. I'd just started my second year, so it would have been like 2012, 2013, roughly. It was Christmas, like holidays from university, and we were at home, and my dad had already, for the sort of past sort of 3 or 4 years, he'd been, maybe not quite that long, but a couple of years prior to that, he'd basically got diagnosed with prostate cancer. And obviously prostate cancer is quite a common thing among men and relatively treatable.
Very treatable.
Yeah. And obviously most men will have it treated, diagnosed, and be fine afterwards. My dad ended up having his prostate removed, but had quite a few complications as a result of it. Just an unlucky case. Went through the kind of treatment of it all. But then in, about 2012, 2013, second university, he was going for like almost essentially kind of like the all clear from the consultant. But him and my mum were noticing like cuts and bruises like in around his body that weren't kind of healing properly.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, that's a little bit strange. We're going to see the prostate consultant, or dad's cancer consultant anyway. Yeah. Let's just mention it to him. And that was when he basically said, oh, right, that's not okay. Like, we need to get some tests done, and had some blood tests done. And yeah, that was Christmas Eve. Dad found out that he was diagnosed with leukemia Christmas Eve.
Before we move on with that, I want to just explore, obviously... You say prostate cancer is treatable, and it is very treatable.
Yeah.
Had you noticed your mental health struggling throughout that, or were you on an equilibrium with it?
Yeah, I think I was, from what I can remember, relatively stable.
Yeah.
Like, I think because my mum and dad, I remember them sitting me and my sister down in the garden and telling us, and they, and it's probably a probably because they didn't want to worry us, but they were quite calm and collected in their manner when they told us, like, and so I guess that translated to my sister as like, oh, maybe this isn't something to worry about. And I think, I can't remember what age we were, but maybe also we were slightly naive to kind of what cancer was and the damage of
course,
it.
Yeah.
And our family hadn't really been affected by it before.
Right.
Like, we'd never experienced the death of like a close family member apart from my dad's mum, my gran, but that was when I was like 4 years old, so I didn't really understand it back then. So we're very fortunate as a family not to have to go through that kind of grieving process. I think me and my sister were probably a bit like unfazed by it because my mum and dad seemed to be. So yeah, for those kind of 2 years prior to my dad's leukemia diagnosis, I don't remember sort of consciously being affected by it. And maybe that was just like I say, a bit of naivety, but I think because mum and dad didn't seem too worried, we weren't. And maybe that was just like a protective mechanism from them, obviously, as their children. So it didn't rub off on us. And because we saw them behaving like that, and we were obviously at a very influential age, we then took it on as well. I'm like, oh, what's to worry about?
With your dad's second diagnosis of leukemia.
Yeah.
Take me back to what on earth was running through your head.
Yeah, so we were in the kitchen in the house. I remember mum telling us, and she immediately just burst into tears. And I think that's where, in comparison to the prostate cancer, when mum and dad told us that, it was really... And mum and dad wasn't with him. He'd had to stay at the hospital and literally start therapy immediately.
Yeah,
Because it was like, this is pretty severe and we need to address it now.
Yeah.
And I remember mum telling us, and yeah, she was just... And I remember her just grabbing me and my sister, and we were just... I was kind of just, you know, when you just... surrealism, and you're like, and you almost can't believe it. You think someone's almost playing a bit of a prank on you. Like, nah, this can't be real. Like, but obviously it was. I don't know what switched, but I think I automatically was like, fuck, I'm now the man of the house almost.
How did that feel?
I don't know why I thought that, because obviously I wasn't, because my dad was still around. Like, although he was in hospital starting chemotherapy and stuff, and he was still a massive, he was still there. Like, he's still alive. He's still my dad. He's still part of the family. I immediately wanted to take on this like burden, or put this burden on myself. And I don't know, I guess if I didn't feel at first pressured by it, I felt...
it was almost instinctive, really.
Yeah, it was totally instinctive, but I think I felt a sense of... like pride, in a way, that I could almost... that I felt like I could shoulder it.
Fascinating.
I probably couldn't, obviously, but I wanted to, and I felt like I could. Yeah, I just wanted to take it on, like head on.
And at this stage, you didn't actually know that his cancer was terminal.
No, we didn't know for 18 months.
18 months,
almost
wow.
2 years.
So you battled it for 2 years.
Yeah, it was a long run. Ups and downs, in and out of isolation, lots and lots of therapy. Good days, bad days. At one point, actually in remission as well. So we were told that he was in remission. So obviously when you get that, you're like, wait, hang on. I used to get so confused with it anyway. I can't remember whether remission is a good thing or a bad thing now.
No, remission is a good thing. Yeah.
Remission is a good thing. So we got told he was in remission. Obviously, that's big news to celebrate.
It's huge, yeah.
But then I don't think it was long after that that we then got... I was away at the time. I remember it so clearly. My dad ringing me and telling me that it basically come back, and it had come back like absolute hellfire. I remember him calling me, and I was in the pub, and I sent him a photo of a packet of crisps and a pint, just because that was the kind of thing we used to do together. And I got a phone call back from him immediately. And sometimes, you know, when you get those phone calls, without even picking up, I was like, this is bad news.
Absolutely.
So why would he ring me back immediately just after? I mean, he loves a packet of crisps and a pint, but he doesn't love it that much. And he told me straight away, and I remember just breaking down on the phone. I was like, what the fuck? I honestly couldn't believe it, because we obviously all felt as a family that we kind of seen the back of it.
Your dad's your role model. You've openly discussed that.
Yeah.
As most dads are for a huge amount of people. Mine was in a similar way, mostly my granddad, though, and he died very suddenly, and it felt like a total emptiness. Like I was in the wilderness. How does somebody deal with receiving a phone call like that whereby your role model, the person you strive to achieve so much for in your life, as you've openly talked about, had terminal cancer. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, like, he was, like you say, a role model, but he's like a life coach, teacher, guide. Mm. And like you just said there, like, lost in the wilderness without a map, without a compass.
Yeah. There's no ordnance.
There's no. And that's the thing. I was like, there's no fixed point for me to work off now, because he's like that voice of reason. I was just, I was lost, I think. And like I said earlier, obviously we felt that Dad could have been a bit more emotionally available. But at the same time, like, I don't know, that probably wasn't the best time to start diving into unpacking his emotional troubles. It starts with, like, right, Dad, you need to start speaking up more. It's like, well, hang on, you're also going through traumatic chemotherapy, and we as a family are being pulled in different directions. So I just, when was that? When that have been? That would have been like second, no, it would have been just 2014, 2015. So I was like just starting rugby, and that was when I was kind of just, oh yeah, I was all over the place. As you can tell by the way I'm speaking, like, your emotions are just a mess. It's making me just like, I'm getting all clammy just thinking about it, because I wanted to, I remember just taking various trips with him to like the hospital when he would be having a checkup, or he'd have to go in for some treatment, or he'd have to be put into an isolation room, because obviously a side effect of leukemia is you're particularly susceptible to infection. And so like your immune system, it just doesn't exist, essentially. So he was often in isolation rooms, and I remember just going in regularly to visit him. And I wanted to know, like, deep down how he was, but at the same time I could tell visibly, like, he was a shell of the man he was, like, lost so much weight, looked different, everything about him, like, obviously lost his hair. And I wanted to kind of speak to him and, I guess, express myself and also find out how he was. But at the same time, I wanted to just be there as like a break for him and a separation from what he was going through. Because if he was just, basically most of the day, he would just be sat in the isolation room by himself, obviously with nurses and doctors coming in and out, attaching different bags of whatever it was to him. And I almost saw myself going in there as his, like, another form of recovery from that.
His release.
His treatment to that.
Mm.
His therapy to that. And so I didn't want to start going in and trying to unpack my negative, or not negative, just my emotions towards the whole situation we were going through, as well as his.
What was the emotions?
It was fear.
Complete despair.
Yeah, I guess fear was probably a massive one, because it was clear, it was like reality was there, in bright, I could see reality, and that was that my dad was literally dying in front of me, like, no two ways about it.
No.
I could see it visibly, like, going in day after day, that his state was just changing, and some days he would, you couldn't almost have conversations with him, because obviously the side effects of all the treatment, sometimes he'd be in a considerable amount of pain, and almost the doctors would have to pretty much sedate him.
Mm.
And just to watch someone deteriorate that like that, when you are so in love with that person, so I was just, I guess I was so scared of losing him. And
the time between his terminal diagnosis
and his death, was like a week. Yeah, roughly a week, something like that.
Do you feel like you had time to say goodbye?
Not really, because he deteriorated massively in that time. And so, and we were just in panic mode. We were like, yeah, like all systems go, like what the hell's happening? So there was no, it just didn't feel right to start to explore those kind of things. So, and you were just working off complete impulse, like day to day, moment to moment, constantly having to also find out information from the doctors and nurses, like asking, is he in pain? Because that's kind of one of our biggest things, was like, we want him to be okay.
Of course, yeah.
Because we obviously knew that we still had each other there at the moment. Like me, mum, and my sister were literally spending pretty much 24/7 at the hospital at this point, pretty much just sleeping, almost living there. Not quite to that extent, but obviously daily trips to the hospital. And yeah, so there was no sense of, I guess, that kind of final conversation.
Your dad passed away, and you go, I want to move away from that because I know it's difficult. We have a period where actually you've gone straight back into rugby, right? And you've talked as well on other platforms how you didn't really have time to grieve. You went straight back into the seventh circuit,
yeah,
at a time of such trauma and heartache. That was obviously quite a good release, I imagine. Back, yeah, to almost some sort of normality, mm-hmm, I suppose.
Yeah, hugely. It was like a distraction. Mm. And again, like, sports are business, and I'm part of that business, and
yeah,
I'm part of the team that's trying to succeed, and I want to be part of the team and the success. And if I'm not around training, then I'm probably going to get cut loose. Mm. And that's my job. That's my livelihood. And obviously he's going through all the stuff with my dad, but, and at the same time, he would have wanted me to continue my dream and keep pursuing it. Mm. And so I used that as like, yeah, my therapy, mm, my distraction, my coping mechanism, mm, wrongly or rightly, was just, right, I'm going to throw myself, mm, back into this.
And you made a promise, didn't,
yeah,
you?
Yeah, literally the moment my dad died, pretty much. Obviously, we're incredibly emotional, and
of course,
you're just like in a state of complete disarray. But we obviously had to say like our last goodbyes and stuff, and I made a promise to dad at that point. I was like, obviously, gave him a hug and stuff, and said like, I promise you, I'm going to go to the Olympics. I'm going to be an Olympian. Because I knew in 6 months' time Rio was happening and Rugby Sevens was starting at the Olympics, and it was already on my radar. Obviously, me and him would have been speaking about it in the months leading up to his death, but I don't know why. I just was like, wow, instinct kicked in. I thought this
is the right thing to do.
This is the right thing to do, yeah. Absolutely. This is almost like my saving grace, whatever it may be.
Your purpose in, yeah, that moment.
And I'm going to do it for you.
Mm.
So I just, yeah, that was the promise I made. I said, I'm going to go to Olympics, I'm going to be an Olympian. And for the next 6 months, I was heavily motivated by that. And it was huge. That was like my fuel, massively. That fueled me big time. Everything I did, wrongly or rightly. But it certainly helped me distract myself, my mindset, focus on my development as a player.
So you're training for Rio.
Yeah.
You're doing a box jump in the gym 2 days before.
Yeah.
You're selected for GB. You're in the gym 2 days before you fly out?
No, we were out there.
You were out in Rio?
We were out in Belo Horizonte, which is an hour's flight north of Rio.
Right, okay.
So we're in holding camp.
Yeah.
Team GB, kitted out, yeah, Adidas head to toe.
Living the dream.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
Olympian, been told at this point that I'm in the squad, in the select 12.
Right, okay.
So I'd achieved what I had promised myself and my dad.
How did that feel?
I remember getting told, and it was just like, just the whole spectrum of emotions, as you can imagine. Like slightly hollow in a way, because obviously I didn't have, he wasn't there for me to be able to tell him. And I tried to fulfill that by like my dad's voice is still on our family voicemail. So whenever I call home and no one picks up, I hear his voice, which is obviously really nice.
And so left there intentionally?
No, I don't think we left it there intentionally. I just don't think we've ever got around to changing it. Okay. Out of pure laziness, maybe. But it's great. We've got some friends that, like, if no one picks up, they end up trying to have pretend they're having a conversation with dad.
That's nice.
Which is really nice.
Really nice.
But yeah, so I went through like processing it by trying to write letters to him, or like just little notes on my phone. That was kind of me telling him, look, Dad, I've achieved it. I'm going to the Olympics. And I told Mum, and she was obviously completely overwhelmed by it. And the support from family and friends was insane.
It's extraordinary, yeah.
But yeah, we were out in Bello in the holding camp with like all the other Team GB athletes. And it's just like a state of kind of like, oh my God, I'm actually here. I'm an Olympian. Wow. Yeah, pretty much. And yeah, that was when we started to basically ramp up training. But then 2 days before,
yeah, you're in the gym.
We're in the gym doing box jump. Yeah. 2 days before we're due to fly into the Olympic Village to like properly kickstart, and I'm doing box jumps, and I come down and I catch my ankle on the edge of the box, on right on the lip. Ankle rolls over as it would usually, but then all my force goes through that, through the deck.
Horrific.
Dislocated ankle, ruptured ligaments. In a lot of pain, excruciating on the floor, and it's just obviously, and there's just like deathly silence in the gym. Everyone's like, what's just happened? And yeah, right then and there, my Olympics was over, essentially. Flown home, surgery, and then watched them go on and win a silver medal, which was pretty rough.
How does that feel?
I was like, part of me was obviously overjoyed at the fact that they'd had the success, because so much shared experience, respect and love for a lot of those guys in the team, all those guys in the team, and we were obviously going out there to succeed as Team GB. And so Team GB were kind of written off before the tournament, so to get silver medal was just insane. But at the same time, I was like, oh, like, I guess they could have won a gold medal, but I was like, can my luck get any worse?
Yeah.
And I was just like, fuck, that should be me. I deserve to be a part of that. And then that's when you get these questions like, why me?
Sure.
Why did this happen to me? I've let myself down. I've let my family down.
And this is where your mental health started to deteriorate, right?
Yeah.
I think, in a way, you didn't have time to grieve.
Like, I didn't give myself time. Because I decided to throw myself back into rugby, I didn't give myself time or space.
And so now you've found yourself on a fucking operating table.
Yeah. Well, that was my second ankle surgery that year. I'd had ankle surgery earlier in the year as well, in January. So like 3 months after my dad died,
I had
ankle surgery after playing in Sydney. And so like in the space of 6-7 months, my dad's died, I've had ankle surgery, been selected for the Olympics, then missed out on the Olympics, and then had ankle surgery again, and then obviously the rehab that ensues after that. And so I was kind of just like thrown from one thing into the next, not allowing any space or time to consider my well-being, and all my attention and focus was going into like next job, essentially, like, okay, rehab, okay, rugby, okay, rehab, Olympics, next thing.
And this is your rut.
Yeah,
the biggest rut of your life.
Yeah, that combination, one of them, certainly was pretty toxic. And that's not to say obviously over the coming years and months, like, I had great success and celebration and good times, because in December that year, 2016, when this next season started, we went to Cape Town and won the Cape Town Sevens of England, and then in 2017 we won the Vancouver Sevens. So I had amazing shared success and memories with them.
Of course.
But in that time, I also had a knee injury. And I remember having that knee injury and being laid on the bed in Vancouver. And that was the year we won. I got injured in the first game, but I was laid in the bed, and Simon, our head coach, was debriefing the team after the first game. And I was laid on the table behind him, like with my head in my hands. And I was just in tears because I just couldn't. I was like, really? Another injury? Like, I just felt like basically, I was, like I say, I was never going to get out of this rut. And it was just one thing after the next. Although nothing felt worse than the previous thing. It was just like, okay, that's another shit experience. That's another shit experience. That's another injury. That's another rehab. Mm. That's another this. That's another that. Yeah. And I was just stuck at rock bottom with all this piling up on me and just weight that I couldn't shift. Mm. Because as soon as I felt like I was gaining momentum, bang.
Another thing,
injury or whatever it may be. It was often injury. That's when I started to question. I was like, my biological makeup. I was like, am I fit enough to be a rugby player? Like, am I actually physically capable to be a rugby player? Will I ever recover? What can I be doing differently? All these sorts of questions, like, and start to really get into this confusing state of being like, this just maybe I'm just not built for this. I'm not made for this.
Mm.
And I couldn't get out of it.
I'd love to. Before the pod, we were talking about our shared passion for actually working or talking about people's whys.
Yeah.
And as you've explored, one of the biggest things that for you with your depression and your mental health problems has been the impact your dad's death had on your why. Before we move into that, because I really want to explore that quite deeply, separating kind of the trauma of your dad's death, how do you think of grief? What do you think grief is? Can you describe it?
Well, I've never had experience of it before, but I saw this brilliant thing. Why did I read it? Well, I can't remember where I read it, but it's grief is love with nowhere to go, which I really loved. When I read it, I was like, wow.
That is fantastic, yeah.
That's bang on.
Yeah.
Like, because so much of grief is like happy memories of that person, missing that person. Well, certainly from my perspective, it's like shared emotions, shared memories, and love. And that, especially that, like the physical connection, like the hugs.
Of course, yeah.
And all those things that come with the relationship of a family member or a loved one. And when I read that, I was like, that is bang on for me. That's what, and I could relate to it so much. Grief is love with nowhere to go. And for me, as well as that, I guess I've looked at it as, because I didn't give myself space for my grieving,
mm.
I've almost looked at it as like a learning tool, because I've realized that if you don't give yourself that space and that time, then it can creep up on you and manifest itself in so many different ways.
Mm. I was going to ask you, how would you have liked to have grieved?
How would I have liked? I guess, but there's no wrong or right way to grieve. Like, for me, I was being completely instinctual. I was going off of what I knew in that moment. I didn't know any different. And how would I have liked to agree? I don't know. If someone else close to me was to die, would I do it any differently? I don't think so. I think I would just trust whatever came naturally to me. I think that's the only way you can grieve. I don't think you can take I don't think you can necessarily see how other people have grieved and grieve the same, because I think it's different for every person.
Mm.
And potentially every single moment of grief is different to the next.
Mm.
Like, there are learnings to be had, but I don't necessarily think that there are guidelines.
Mm.
Grief guidelines.
No, it's very, yeah. It's very unique. It's,
yeah. I guess I just would have spoken more. If anything, I would have spoken about it more, and my feelings towards it, and the results of the grief that I was facing with Dad. Mm. If anything, that would be what I would do next time. And it's really hard, because obviously people find grief, death, let's put cancer in that category as well, awkward to talk about.
Yes.
and people don't want to address those subjects or maybe ask you a question about it because they're nicely being very considerate of that person's emotions, and they think, oh, if I ask them, oh, how are you after your dad, like after your dad's death or your mum's death, that you're going to basically spark up. This person's going to have a mental breakdown in front of you, emotional breakdown. And but so often those people are seeking avenues to be able to speak about it, because often they don't, like, if you were to ask me, having obviously not met my dad, what was your dad like? That's an opportunity for me then to be like, oh, you know what, my dad was brilliant, or he was an absolute plonker, or whatever it may be. Like, it's an opportunity for that person to express themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's what like people who aren't going through the grieving but can see a person who is grieving have to realize, is that it's going to be uncomfortable for you to maybe ask that question, but it's going to make that person feel so much more comfortable to be able to think, oh, actually, I remember I watched this brilliant clip around probably the death of my dad, and it was Draymond Green, who plays for the Golden State Warriors basketball. Oh, yeah. And there was one of the legendary coaches, I think coaches the Spurs, Popovich, his wife had died. And Draymond Green was finishing a press conference, and there'd been a big outpouring of love when this coach's wife had died. And obviously the NBA all kind of showed their support towards him. But Draymond Green finished his press conference, and just as he was about to leave, he picked up the mic and said, oh, I just want to shout out to Pop, say we're all thinking of you and like hope you're doing well. And this was like probably 4 or 6 weeks, and it's so easy for people to just forget and move on when obviously you forget that person's still going through the process. And I thought that was really, it was just such a present thought he had, to be like, we've moved on because obviously our lives and we're not associated with that grief, but that person's still suffering potentially with it. So we have to continue to recognize that they're going on this journey. And constantly remember to tap in with them and check in. I just thought, I remember that always sticks out in my mind, just seeing that. I thought it was really cool from him.
Agreed. Nice.
Gone on a bit of a ramble there.
No, mate, love it. I want to talk about your rut and what the fuck it felt like being down there.
Yeah.
Where there's just no way out. You're honestly.
That's what I said earlier. It just felt so weighed down because, well, like I said earlier, my dad was like my kind of sounding board, and I was at this in this pit. And if I'd been in this rut before, I would have asked him, or he may have had like a, because he was kind of his dad died when he was 19, so he kind of had that similar experience. But his choice of dealing with it was kind of like drop out of uni, run away, go live in Africa, escapism. Run away from all your fears and hopes and dreams or whatever, because I don't know, that's what he felt was the right thing to do.
Well, one set there as well. We just had breakfast, right?
Yeah.
Anybody watching this or listening?
Yeah.
We've just had breakfast, and you said to me, I asked you, you had extreme thoughts around running away.
Yeah, now, yeah.
Presumably, did you know he'd obviously run away to Africa?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Those extreme thoughts around running away, right?
Yeah.
Do you reckon coincidentally interconnected or not?
I think they definitely connected. Yeah, 100%. And because he always used to also, like, as much as that was obviously the coping mechanism for the death of his dad, like, he speaks so fondly of that time as well because of the life experience and the exposure it gave him to a whole new world in Africa and a whole new way of living. But I think from hearing those stories about him as a young guy going to Africa, living in Botswana for like 2 or 3 years, he lived, and he had like, he used to tell us he had like rattlesnakes as pets, like,
wow,
some sort of Steve Irwin wannabe or something. Yeah. But yeah, we, and so I think that certainly rubbed off on me. As I said earlier, I was a kind of kid who used to just push the boundaries and explore and play and whatever. So I think for me, I certainly was like, oh, actually, you know what? When I was going through my grief, I was like, maybe I'm just going to run away and detach myself from all of this madness. So there was definitely something that, there's definitely a crossover there. I'd have.
And you, one of the coping, you want to explore the coping mechanisms when depression for you was a complete reality. There was nothing in life, or there was very little in life.
Well, rugby was still an outlet.
Yeah.
Like, it definitely helped me. But I was... Obviously, time was going on. My dad and the Rio Olympics had been a massive why for me, but I was having to start to readdress that through the help of our team psychologist, because I think she could recognise that I was struggling and not addressing it. But I had to start to figure out, like, why am I doing this anymore? Like, what's the reason? What's the point? Why do I want to be a professional rugby player? Obviously, part of it was the enjoyment and the fun, but my dad and the Rio Olympics had now passed me by. But then I was struggling with the thought of, but if I start to basically form a new why, am I then waving goodbye? And
what did that feel like?
That was one of the, I think probably one of the toughest processes to go through, because it just felt like I was just losing connection with my dad more. Obviously, I couldn't speak to him. And I had to start to figure out that basically using him as my fuel wasn't powerful enough anymore. And that's not to say that he still couldn't be a part of it, but he probably couldn't be the... He couldn't be the sole reason. And that meant I had to... face the uncomfortable truth and the pain that came with it. And that was about, like, unpacking emotions and letting go. And I think that was when I was in, like, that deep recess of kind of just no escape. It was a really strange, difficult, painful, but also quite enlightening experience, because I saw the power that I could have and achieve by letting go a little bit and just loosen the grip, because it then allowed me more space and room for other things to flourish and grow and support me. I wasn't just being propped up by the motivation of making my dad proud. I could also have these other foundations that worked alongside and was almost more powerful and stronger because I wasn't just working off of one thing. I was working off, like, three things. And that was quite a big thing that I was able to recognize and open my eyes up.
On your Instagram, you've got a lovely few, well, there's three or four pictures of you presenting to your teammates on a beach. And obviously your mum and your auntie are there.
Yeah.
Talking about your why.
Yeah.
Your why, obviously, going to Rio was, right, my dad has passed away, my role model in my life, I'm going to get to Rio for you, Dad. This is my why. That came crashing down and left you in a state of complete disarray, where you're like, well, what the fuck is my why now? Sound very value-driven, which is important in life. What's your why now, and how did that process evolve? Obviously, and what was the kind of, what did you say to your teammates on that beach?
Yes, that was early this year. That was March this year or February this year. So just before lockdown and the world went into whatever state it's in right now. Who knows?
No.
But yeah, we're in LA.
A little bit slower.
Yeah, a little bit slower, which is a nice pace of life. It's a nice pace of life.
Story for another day.
Yeah. But yeah, we're in LA, and that was my first tournament back. I'd been out for 14 months prior to that. And
it's a long fucking
time. Yeah, long time, four surgeries. And I was like days away from basically calling quits and being like, I'm going to have to retire, career ending injuries, more feelings of depression and being in that rut. But I managed to get back fit and was asked to present the shirts to the boys on the beach in LA, which was such a unique setting. My mum and auntie were there, as you said. And well, I basically just...
Why were you asked to do that?
Well, a really cool thing, basically, at England Sevens, in the last year or two, we basically recognised that for a lot of people, some people may receive that shirt and that could be their one and only time they represent England Sevens. And we wanted to make the shirt presentation a bit more of a special thing. And we started this thing where it used to be basically we just go into Simon, our head coach's room, and we present the shirts in the room. But we decided to start doing them because we get to travel the world to these insane places. So we thought, right, let's get a different person in each location in a unique setting to present the shirt and basically tell them, tell their story, tell their why.
It's fantastic.
Tell everyone what that shirt, that moment
means to them.
Mm. So we decided to do that, and I got asked, because I hadn't done it, because I'd been out for such a long period of time, to do it in LA for my return. And I just went on. Quite a lot of people had told their stories about like their introduction to rugby and their journey for rugby to getting to England. But I decided to speak openly about, and which everyone was very aware of, my journey with the death of my dad, my why, that changing, and now what it is now. And I just spoke about how much my family means to me, and how special it was to have my mum and auntie there. The fact that the last 14 months being out for injury had made me realise that not solely that, but even more so how fragile, impermanent, short, like a rugby or a sports career can be. And you just have to live in the moment and take every opportunity you can whilst you're in it, because you just honestly don't know when your last one is. And for me, that was what I was trying to express to the boys, like when we go out and play this weekend, just enjoy it, love it, because it could quite easily be the last time we ever get to do this. And it could well be now, seeing as rugby sevens isn't returning. But I spoke about how also I just want to be, and I got quite emotional because I obviously had to speak about dad and stuff, and I just spoke about how I'd gone through that reforming process, and now I wanted to be a role model to them and people around me and supporters of England rugby as I guess a voice for like we spoke about emotional awareness, emotional vulnerability, and be a support and a role model to my peers, that we can have shit times, but look at me now, I'm still here, I'm standing. Mm. I may not have got back to playing, but I have. Yeah, and it was just really special. Mm. And I'm very grateful for that experience to be able to share that with them, and hope that at least one person, if one person took something away from it, that's all I can ask for.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think you've battled depression.
Mm.
Saw the psychotherapist, psychologist.
Team psychologist.
And your way of getting out of your rut was to really, in essence, to reframe why the fuck are you playing?
Mm.
Or what's next? Why are you doing what you're doing? What did you reframe your old why into?
When my dad died, I basically, whenever I've played rugby since, I've written dad on my wrist tape and dedicate all my tries to him whenever I score, which isn't very often at the moment, but I just started to like figure out like what is it that I love about rugby? What does rugby do for me and for other people that I enjoy? And that's when I started to realize that it can be basically a vehicle for something else.
Mm.
And like the hardships that I have gone through and I associate with my career, because I've had great success, but I guess when I was growing up I never thought it'd be such a kind of a hard time of injuries, as obviously you dream of it being,
of course,
plain sailing.
Yeah, exactly. Winning World Cups and being a bloody celebrity when you're like 16 years old. But yeah, so I was like, right, what do I love about the sport? What do I love about the people that I'm involved with in the sport? And that, and I've said it twice there, but love for me was a huge thing. Like, I love the Sevens program. I love the people that are involved in it and the dedication and the commitment they show to what our values were. And that was like making England proud. And just having this shared love for one another. And I think part of me realized that my dad would have encouraged me and wanted me to go on this journey of discovery and figuring out what was going to ultimately help me perform best on the pitch. And he would have helped me basically find those things out. And if that meant that I would have to change things, he would have encouraged that.
Mm.
And changing things was saying, okay, well, my dad can't be the only reason why I'm playing rugby anymore. It has to be something not necessarily bigger and better, but something else to join forces. And that's where I was like, I want to be a role model for people.
Mm.
And I just want to be a good person.
Well, let's talk about mental health now.
Yeah.
Because we've spent 57 minutes and 50 seconds talking about the past, and actually in the present you're in a very interesting situation right now. The RFU have just cut the Sevens program.
Mm.
And obviously appreciate that you don't want to be slagging off, in essence.
Yeah.
your kind of former employees,
yeah,
the employees that have kind of put your contract on hold for the time being.
Us, yeah.
But how on earth does it feel?
Just obviously there's good days and bad days. Like, I've enjoyed lockdown because I've been able to switch off from the performance element of rugby and professional sport. Like, that's been great. And also it's made me be able to reflect on those 14 months getting back to fit and realize that actually, okay, I needed this break more than I thought I did. Because obviously we were preparing for Tokyo 2020 Olympics. And so when I got back fit, I was like, right, that's the next goal. And now, having had this break, I've been like, okay, actually those 14 months they're taking a big toll. So now I've been able to enjoy this period. But just in terms of how my mental health now towards the RFU and towards the processes we've been through, just feel a sense of neglect.
Yeah.
Abandoned. Because as I've already spoken about passionately, our Sevens program is built on our relationships and the connections we have with the people involved in it. And we don't have that and haven't had that for the last 6 months. And it's hard because I don't want anyone to think that I feel we as Sevens players or as a rugby team are entitled to anything, because it's clear to see that the whole world is suffering right now and people are losing jobs and businesses are being closed all around the world. But there could have been, I think, just more consideration from the RFU to the welfare of our program and the value of it for the next generation of players. If they honestly care about grassroots rugby or developing rugby in England, then we see ourselves as role models that travel the world. And if you're not willing to invest in us, then potentially they're missing an opportunity for the growth of the sport.
Where do you see Sevens going now? And actually, when we were having breakfast, you were talking about your coaches who were implementing slightly contrarian methods to training, and that has sparked or reinvigorated kind of life in terms of your enjoyment for the game, which is just fantastic. And thinking about past mindfulness in essence, which is brilliant. Like, where do you see Sevens going now?
It's hard. It's international, which doesn't help itself, obviously. No. But I just think a lot of the England Sevens boys are went through like the university pathway, and that is such a great breeding ground for play and a very open style of rugby. And I think that's just it's potentially they're missing out on opportunity to really attract, I think, young players, because it has that, it's an opportunity to be creative, to express yourself. You have freedom, you have license to, obviously some sevens players have got ridiculous sidesteps and feet and fast. And it's just really raw in its essence. And I think it's just, it could, it's just an attractive way to bring people in, because you can get some amazing individual athletes that can light up a stage. Like if you look at the Americans, like Carl Niles didn't even know what rugby was, and then within a year he's like the number one sevens name in the world,
same as Perry Baker.
Yeah, and they'll be like, the sport will be blowing up in America thanks to them, and I think it's brilliant.
Must be a fucking nightmare to play against.
Oh, absolute
yeah
disaster. Yeah, but they just think you'd be doing the same.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's terrifying. One on one with 15 meters either side of you. It's like,
oh my lord,
just go on, score, you can try, you can have it. Yeah. But yeah, I just think they're potentially missing an opportunity to really tap into a market and attract young kids in. It's just a way to have fun and play. I think that's what's great about it.
We were talking as well over breakfast about how this kind of, this is almost a slightly strange opportunity for you to look at what life is like outside of rugby, where your passions lie. It's a daunting landscape, actually, for any professional sportsman who's known professional sports for a long, long time.
But yeah.
I suppose you're quite lucky in a sense with the entire situation. It's given you a, your journey's given you this fisheye perspective, lens perspective on your life.
Yeah, it certainly has. I guess there's definitely at the moment a sense of identity loss, because from the age of, well, whenever I started professional rugby, like that's kind of all I've done in terms of life, work experience. I don't have work experience. Most work experience I've got is the local fish counter in Waitrose back in Bristol.
Mate, you stick the Rub podcast work experience.
Yeah, maybe. Mate, I'd be straight on LinkedIn. Yeah. But like, yeah, so there's definitely a sense of like that losing that identity as a rugby player. And I haven't actually really spoken to, I think I maybe spoken to one person about this so far, but, and we've briefly touched on it in this podcast earlier, but like, certainly felt a real desire, particularly recently, to speak to my dad and have some sort of guidance, because potentially, yeah, this is potentially, hopefully not, but this could be me transitioning out of the sport. And sometimes that's where you speak to your teachers or your role models and think, all right, let's explore what your other strengths or weaknesses are, your passions outside of it. And obviously I can do that with myself and with other people, but I've definitely missed him recently about, and just, I don't know, just wanting to speak to him about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the same time, I'm because I was close to retiring at the end of last year, I was starting to prepare myself anyway for the next chapter in my life. And I knew, obviously, like you said earlier, sport's a finite career or length of career. And so I knew at some point retirement's going to come. So I'm kind of, yeah, I'm prepared for it. And I've started to explore those passions.
What do you think your dad would have said in this situation? I'm just interested.
I think he would have told me to just trust myself.
Yeah.
In a way, something will work out. Obviously, you have to put a bit of effort in, but if you're willing to put the effort in, it will work out. But I think ultimately, he would have just told me to trust me, and to trust me and speak, network. He was a brilliant networker. Just use those connections and speak to people, even if it's just like, what's the worst that could happen? You ask someone a question or you ask someone for a job and they say no. Oh, isn't that, that's not the end of the world.
No, it's not. No.
Yeah, as much as we kind of build up this idea in our head that, oh my God, I'm going to get denied or rejected, it's not that big a deal. So he would have just told me those sorts of things, like pretty simple advice. So, I mean, as much as I know what he would have told me, I still part of me craves that, to hear it from him, because it's just, I guess it's just more reassuring.
There's a lovely quote I saw recently on failure and rejection, which is, there's no such thing as failure, just the outcome to a situation.
Yeah. Yeah, nice.
It's very true.
Yeah, it's cool.
Because there's a huge, I have a fear of failure. Everybody, it's often what drives people to do things, but yeah, reframing that mental model.
Yeah, it's like also challenges or hurdles, aren't they? They're actually kind of just opportunities disguised, hidden opportunities.
The brilliant book by Ryan Holiday, The Obstacle is the Way.
Yeah.
It literally is.
Yeah.
It is fascinating.
Yeah, I haven't read that.
You should.
I will, yeah. And so that's the kind of mindset I'm trying to have. And I've also just taken this time as a, almost just a, like I said earlier, like a natural break of recovery. Used to spending a lot of time away from home, away from my mum and sister, traveling. So I've actually really enjoyed being back in Bristol and living with my mum, which was a weird thing to adjust to, but I would never have had this experience if it hadn't been for this moment in time. So that's the way I'm trying to look at it.
Yeah, nice.
And ultimately just try to be the best version of myself. And that's about, like, when I am having a bad day, which I've had bad days, I've had real bad days, I'm like, oh fuck, what am I gonna do? Rugby's over, or I'm not gonna be getting paid after this month. I kind of just think about those moments with my mum and stuff that I wouldn't have had if it wasn't for this time, and kind of just be grateful for that and be, yeah, the best version of me.
I love that.
Yeah.
I won't keep you too much longer because there's currently flies flying around us because we stink so much.
I'm so sweaty.
It's so hot. I want to finish,
yeah,
like we do on this podcast, and especially in season two now, with five questions.
Yeah.
And I know you were, when I told you some of the questions beforehand, you were like, fucking hell.
Yeah,
okay, deep. Here we go. Yeah. The first one's not that deep, but what's your favourite book and why?
I'm not a massive reader, I'll be honest. I'm more of a buy a book, start it, don't finish it kind of guy, which is not a good trait to have.
Oh, but I'm like that.
But yeah.
It gets you through books.
It does.
Say you're a voracious reader.
Yeah. So what's my favourite book and why? What springs to mind? During lockdown, I read a lot of Roald Dahl and Winnie the Pooh stuff.
Really?
But yeah, I don't know. Like, I just like the childhood kind of escapism bit.
That wasn't what I was expecting.
No, I know.
I must admit.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is like one of my favourite. Really? No, not Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Sorry, Danny the Champion of the World.
Okay.
I love that because it's all about the dad and the son's relationship.
Nice.
But they wouldn't, I wouldn't say they're my favourite books, but I enjoyed reading them. I reckon I'm going to go for one that's had probably the biggest effect on me, and it's called Lost Connections by Johan Hari, who I think is, I don't know, I'm not going to guess his nationality. Anyway, and it was about, and his journey with depression.
Wow.
And he talks about how he has been through the whole kind of medication prescription, all that sort of thing, but realistically he's found that the reason for his depression, or a large majority of it, is he's lost connection with his friends, he's lost connection with his purpose, he's lost connection with his job,
of course. Yeah.
But and I just found it, there's lots of scientific studies in it, but I just thought it was, and just so much it resonated with me, and I was like, it was when I was going through stuff, and I was just like, wow, this really opened my eyes up to, and I've realized how much, because I neglected my friends for a bit, didn't want to socialize, and since then, when I just now seek opportunities to socialize and see people, and that book really opened my eyes up to it some more.
Nice.
Yeah.
The next question, which I know you're kind of dreading.
That wasn't a quick answer either.
No, can we keep it to 60 seconds?
Yeah.
What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
This is a great question, and it's a hard one. I know it's true, and I kind of hate. We did speak about it earlier. I think it's, you can't please everyone, and I hate that. And like often, you'll have to let someone down somewhere,
yeah.
And it could just be the fact that you've been invited to two different drinks events on a Saturday night, or you've been asked someone over for two different barbecues, but you have to say one to someone and yes to the other, and you just can't please everyone.
No.
And I think I really struggle with saying no to people.
Yeah.
And it's such a bad thing, so I get caught up in it and I end up putting myself into more shit because I say yes to both people, and then I have to, and then I'm like, oh God, I let someone else down. And it's like, actually, just say no and then I'll understand.
Yeah.
So I hate it, but it's true.
Nice. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone.
Yeah.
Rings you and says he's having a really bad day. What do you say to him?
What's going on? Talk to me. And just, I guess, just be open or ask if they want to go, do want to meet up. Try and make them feel as comfortable to speak out. So just be like, what's going on, pal? Talk to me. It's pretty simple.
Powerful but simple.
Yeah, talk to me. Tell me what's going through your mind. Whatever you feel comfortable sharing with me, go for it. It's yours, like, I guess, not your secret safe of me, but like, I'm not going to pass on anything. However, just talk to me. Yeah,
it's gonna be
all right.
Yeah,
whatever it is, like, we'll work through it. I'll help you where I can, but I'm here to listen.
Sympathy, not empathy.
Yeah.
When you're struggling with something, struggling yourself, what's your go-to? What do you do?
So during lockdown, I basically decided, I don't know, have you seen the video of the guy, the black guy getting out of the car and doing the, it's Friday then, doing that dance. Yeah. Basically, I love that video. It gives me so much energy. And at the start of lockdown, I've decided to do that every single Friday, send it to a select few people. And I've themed every single one, dress up, film myself, dance that song. And even on bad days, I've been like, oh, I can't do it. But then I do it. And I dance to music and I dress up. And honestly, I feel so good afterwards.
I honestly hope to God I'm on the receiving end of one of those.
Wait, you can be on the list now, and I'll share some of the previous ones with you. I did like a tribute to,
love that,
Captain Tom 1 week. I've done like a V day one.
Oh,
honestly,
my Lord.
And it gives me such a buzz.
That's genius.
And I think that's partly it. That, and I love listening to music.
Yeah.
Like, music for me is just a massive mood booster.
Really?
Yeah, I just stick it. I literally, if I'm walking down this, if I'm literally just popping out to get milk, I'll stick my headphones in, listen to music.
Got milk.
For me, it's just a boost.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got really into George Benson. This is really weird, but I got really into George Benson recently.
Okay, right, nice.
Just.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's epic. I love it. I think it's, and it's just universal. Like, it's the language of the world. Like, yeah, doesn't matter what language you speak, you can listen to music and like relate to it.
Yeah. And also your infamous dog that's always on Instagram.
Archie, yeah. I took him for a walk on Monday last week when we found out about the RFU basically cutting the sevens program. And I had a ball on me, and he is obsessed with balls. Like, I take ball over food for a Labrador is unheard of.
Yeah.
And I remember just having the ball in my hand, and I was obviously feeling pretty shit about things. But he just had the biggest smile on his face. And I just looked down at him and was like, how can I be in a bad mood when he's there just staring up at me, fixing this ball?
We were talking about it earlier, how we've gone way over 60 seconds here. But
yeah.
But we were talking about it earlier, how dogs have got such a simple model of the world.
Easy.
You could learn so much from them.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
I know.
Yeah.
No cares in the world. He just wants to play with his ball.
No fucks given. It's just ball. Give me ball. Ball is life. It's great. You're lying on your deathbed, and you're looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
Mm. being a voice of change.
Interesting.
That sounds really, really like empowering, but I guess...
Sounds very Martin Luther King.
It does, doesn't it? And I'm definitely not putting myself on that sort of pedestal.
Explain that.
Well, I just think because I've, like...
What change are you trying to drive first?
Say that again.
What change are you trying to drive? The voice of change, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I guess I just through, like, I'm not like I see these like now as obviously we've spoken about like therapy, almost therapy sessions. And if I just affect one person,
yeah,
like, and that has an effect on that person, for me, that's change. And I'm talking about like mistakes I've made and experiences I've had and lessons I've learned. And for me, that's something I'm really proud of, is that I've been able to basically recognize that some things were going wrong in my life that needed addressing, and I've made a conscious effort to change them.
When you said that, actually, I was thinking, fucking hell, yeah, that is very Martin Luther. Actually, that is incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, I just, like, I've done a few pods and often speak about the same sort of subject matter, but like I say, if it's just, if it reaches one other new person that hasn't listened to any of the previous ones, then for me, like that's a good thing. Like, it doesn't matter whether everyone else is like, oh, I've listened to half an hour of this, you know what, this bloke's really boring. Yeah. I'm going to switch off. But one person carries on listening for the rest of the pod. For me, that's effective.
Nice.
Yeah. Really. So I'd be proud of that.
Very nice. We've done an hour and 18 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think I've lost half my body weight in yeah, sweat. Yeah,
dripping. The sun's slowly moving around onto this leg now as well.
I know. Thank you so much.
I've loved it. I really appreciate it. And like, men's mental health is really important subject matter. So you're doing a great thing.
Thanks. Yeah, we're trying to get men talking. And,
yeah.
And yeah, you coming on the pod and talking about some of the most intimate parts of your darkest moments is incredible, and you articulated it amazingly well.
Thanks.
And yeah, pleasure to host you. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's great.
So thank you.
Thanks for having me on the rut.
Alex, you are proper gent and a top man for coming on this week and being so open and vulnerable with your truth. When we've spoken in the past, you have always talked about how you now want to use your experiences to help others. And I must admit, that podcast, I'm sure, will touch many, many hearts out there. It's honest, open, difficult to listen to in parts because I could see how much your dad, and I can hear how much your dad meant to you, and still does, obviously. So I just want to say a massive, massive thank you for spending an hour and, 15, 20 minutes with me talking about the deepest parts of your life and how the events that unfolded affected you. Death and ensuing grief is one of life's constants, actually. It will happen to us one day, and there isn't too much we can do about it. But grief hits you in the nuts when you're least expecting it. But the way you've dealt with grief and used it to your advantage as your driver now and your why is phenomenal. So hats off. Next week on the podcast, I'm delighted to welcome the brilliant former cricketer, Luke Sutton, who talks about his battle with his mental health, but more importantly, his battle with being an alcoholic and falling off the rails. We talk about how ending up in rehab as a professional sportsman and the conversations that he had in rehab completely changed his life. And we also talk about what it's like to be a sports agent in the run-up to Luke's new book, which I think is actually out now, The Middleman. So check this out. It's not one to be missed. See you next week.